You know what, Alan? The Russia-Ukraine situation has gotten completely out of hand and is a major global problem. Major global problem.
You want to know who a major global problem is besides you? Is China. You know, they're watching the world's reaction, and I think that's going to determine whether they invade Taiwan or not.
Yeah, I think you probably need to watch what you're saying, especially in regards to China. You probably don't need to speak ill of them.
Why? Am I offending anybody?
Well, more than likely. Remember, we had a guy that canceled on us probably because we spoke ill of China. Keep that in mind.
Okay.
Words have consequences.
I'll walk on eggshells.
Exactly. And speaking of walking on eggshells, we've got a guy who does not walk on eggshells, and he's going to blow your mind on the China problem. Oh. China situation.
China.
China. Hey, what's up, everyone? Welcome to another episode of the Sons of History podcast. I'm Dustin Bass.
And I'm Alan Joaquin.
And we're going to have a great time on this episode. This guy is like the guy when it comes to knowing about China. So I'm really looking forward to this conversation.
You know, there's an old Vulcan proverb that only Nixon could go to China.
An old Vulcan?
What is that? Star Trek VI?
Man.
The Undiscovered Country. Yeah, that was a good...
You know what's funny? Is I was hoping that you weren't talking about Star Trek. It's a show that I never understood why people got into. Just really...
It has its good moments. It's got...
Obviously, great, that one wasn't one of them.
Yeah, but that was... Come on, Mr. Spock said that. Leonard Nimoy.
Leonard Nimoy. All right. Speaking of whoever you just talked about.
Wow. That's
how far back in history is that?
A lot of Star Trek people now.
Do we have Star Trek fans that watch our show?
Sure.
I hope not. No, that's cruel and unusual. I shouldn't have said that. That may offend some
people. Well,
the way
Star Wars has been tanking, I'm sure a lot of people are going to start shifting to Star Trek.
Yeah, they probably will.
Episode
speaking of shifting, how about we shift to This Week in History?
Oh, perfect idea.
All right, so my selection for This Week in History is the year that I was born, and it's March 30th, 1981. Who was president? This guy, Ronald Reagan, and he had just started his presidency. I think this was an old high school buddy of yours, John Hinckley Jr., walked out and about.
No, I wasn't in high school. I was in junior high. And what you're about to discuss, I remember the day. I remember where I was.
Where were you?
I remember...
were you in front of the TV?
Kingwood Middle School, and my English teacher, Miss Cuvion, announced that President Reagan had been shot. I remember that. I always remember.
How was her reaction? What was her reaction?
There was not a, like, she wasn't sad or anything like that. She was just, like, just announcing it. Like, she couldn't wait to announce it to us. I mean, that was the impression I got.
Yeah. Pro-Soviet?
But then I had one of my classmates was also saying that he saw the video or something of him being shot on TV. And, you know, we didn't have smartphones to
no,
watch
we didn't.
Back then. So it
but
was,
we did have smarter people, it seems. But anyway, speaking of smart people and people who aren't smart, John Hinckley Jr. would be one of those non-smart people. He fired off 6 shots, hit Reagan, got him in the lung, and hit 3 other people, one of them being James Brady. And he was, he was the press secretary for Ronald Reagan. He got shot in the head, and he lived, recovered, and he became a supporter of gun control, hence where we get the Brady Bill from. And speaking of Hinckley, check this out. Attempts to assassinate the president is found not guilty by reason of insanity, which, okay, I get that. He's insane. Don't understand the not guilty verdict, though. Eventually released from prison on conditions. So here's the thing. He tries to assassinate the president and never went to prison for it. went to hospitalization.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't his fault. It was his crazy brain. Right? Now, it really wasn't his fault. I think it was Paul Schrader's fault. Because Paul Schrader wrote Taxi Driver. And Taxi Driver became his obsession, in which he ended up watching, I don't know how many times, became obsessed with Jodie Foster. So if anybody needs to go to prison, I guess it would have been Paul Schrader. Anyways, but what?
Kind of ironic. He was doing that to impress Jodie Foster.
There we go.
She didn't even like guys. You know, I mean, a waste. Yeah. I mean, you know, if you're going to do it to impress someone, do it, you know, try to do it to impress somebody who likes guys.
I mean, somebody should have walked up to John Hinckley. Well, maybe it was too soon to tell, but, you know, tell him like, hey, dude, Jody's not interested in you. In fact, she's not interested in any of us. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But this all leads up to my joke, and the joke lands on my shirt. What did JFK and Ronald Reagan have in common? George H.W. Bush.
Mm. Oh, yes. Yes. I heard that one.
So, I don't get that one.
Yeah, I did hear that one.
Look it up. All right, that's my This Week in History.
You know, we used to joke around, I think it was in 2016. I think he was released around that time, or was about to, Hinckley was.
Mm-hmm.
And we were joking around about how, you know, Hillary Clinton, you know, wanted to date Jodie Foster, you know, to coincide with his release. Anyway, okay.
What do you think? Come on.
Nothing.
Come on.
Nothing.
Give me some.
All right. Mine is going to be, now we're going to go back a ways to March 29, 1461, the Battle of Towton. And what was that, you ask? You didn't.
What was that?
That was a major battle, the Wars of the Roses. Largest land battle fought on the island of Britain. It was the Wars of the Roses were, you had the Yorkists, who had the white rose, or represented by the white rose, and then you had the Lancasters, represented by the red rose. So now Henry VI was a very weak king, but his wife was pretty strong. She was a French princess named Margaret of Anjou. So because Henry VI was so weak, there was a conflict between him and Richard York. You know, they're all descendants of Edward III. And, you know, that there was a series of battles. And now Richard was eventually killed, but his son, Edward, who became Edward IV, he was supported with the Earl of Warwick, who they called him the King Master or something. Something about marrying kings. I don't remember what it was. Queen something. Anyway, okay. I don't know, but the Earl of Warwick. So you had Edward the Fourth, the Warwick, Earl of Warwick, and the Yorkists defeated the Lancasters, the House of Lancaster, at the Battle of Towton on March 29, 1461. God, you know,
it's, you need to do like some speech exercises before coming over.
Well, you know,
that's what you need to do. Like, tip of the tongue, top of the teeth. Tip of the tongue, top of the teeth. Yow, 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 yow.
Polished. I'm just
you've been doing this long enough.
Well, you know,
to be polished. Well, I don't want to hear any more excuses.
You're the one that took acting classes and all that. So,
well,
anyway, so yeah, you had about 50 upward to 60,000 people that were in the battle. Again, like half the Lancasters were killed practically. And Margaret of Anjou and Henry VI fled. And then, you know, Earl of Warwick was going to find a wife for Edward, but he secretly married a Lancaster widow named Elizabeth. And that that kind of pissed off the Earl of Warwick. And so he sided with with Edward's brother George. And then they worked with the deposed Henry VI. So it just became Wars of the Roses. It just continued because the Earl of Warwick did not like Elizabeth. And she was hot, from my understanding.
From your understanding.
Yep. So
from what I understand.
So now Richard he stayed allied with his brother Edward. And so it was Edward and Richard. Now Richard would end up becoming Richard III, the famous Richard III, who became king when Edward died in 1483. And his two sons, Edward, who became Edward V, and Richard, they became the princes of the towers. And they think Richard III had them killed. Hmm. And then, you know, Richard III then was attacked by Henry Tudor.
Yeah.
So it's all pretty. But anyway, yeah. But so, yeah, that what gave Edward the temporary, he was king twice because Henry VI came back. But that all occurred in 1461, March 29.
Very interesting. And the last Lancaster actually died in 1994. King Bert the First.
No, I didn't know that one.
Yeah, so sad.
But I know when Henry Tudor killed Richard III at Battle of Bosworth.
Okay.
And they just found his body not too long ago under a parking lot.
Yeah, under a parking lot. Yeah. And that's something. That's where I'm about to put you if you don't shut up. All right.
But, you know.
All right, that's it. Well. Ladies and gentlemen, This Week in History. All right, well, ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, we've got a great, great guest on the show, Stephen Mosier. He is going to be joining us. He is one of the foremost authorities on China and is the author of the book my good friend Alan is holding up, Bully of Asia. He is also the author of several other books, including Hegemon, China's Plan to Dominate Asia and the World, China Attacks, A Mother's Ordeal, One Woman's Fight Against China's One-Child Policy, and the soon-to-be-coming-out book, The Politically Incorrect Guide to Pandemics. Now, this little excerpt, you can put that down. This little excerpt is from the Population Research Institute website, of which he is the president of the Population Research Institute. And it writes, in 1979, Stephen was the first American social scientist to visit mainland China. He was invited there by the Chinese government, where he had access to government documents and actually witnessed women being forced to have abortions under the new one-child policy. Mr. Mosier was a pro-choice atheist at the time, but witnessing these traumatic abortions led him to reconsider his convictions, and eventually he became a practicing pro-life Roman Catholic. So, quite a fascinating story, quite a fascinating book, and I can't believe that you've really screwed up my ability to speak. It's contagious, like a pandemic.
Like COVID?
Just like COVID. Well, without further ado, we do have Stephen Mosier on the line. Steve, thank you so much for joining us. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, guys.
Fantastic. We're going to learn a lot. I already predict we're going to learn a lot about what's going on in China, our relationship with China, China's relationship with the world. And so I guess buckle up and get ready. And when I say get ready, why don't you get ready with your question?
No, I'm getting
ready. Yeah, go ahead.
All right. You ready?
I'm ready.
Are you ready, Steve?
I'm here.
All right. So the first question, I'll kind of do kind of a lead up to it. I did a video not too long ago for the Sons of History Facebook Live about the differences between Red China and Taiwan. And because there's anytime you criticize China, you are labeled a racist. So, you know, with what went on in 1949 with Chiang Kai-shek and Mao Zedong, can you explain to the audience what is the difference between China and Taiwan? And who was our friend? And how did all this come about?
Well, the difference between Taiwan and the People's Republic of China is night and day. With the People's Republic of China being night, as dark as the pit of hell, and the island of Taiwan, the free island of Taiwan with 24 million Chinese, is day, the broad sunlit uplands of freedom. And I can't put it in any starker terms than that. Here you have a perfect comparison in the world between the prosperity and freedom of a free people and the despotism and tyranny of a people who are not free because they're laboring under the yoke of a Chinese Communist Party, which not only seized power throughout all of mainland China in 1949, wants to hold power forever, and has been exploiting the Chinese people ever since it took power. And by exploiting, I mean My goodness, the premier of China, Wen Jiabao, from 2002 when he took office to 2012 when he left, accumulated a fortune in excess of $3 billion. That's pretty good on a monthly salary of around $5,000, $6,000. So he's either the most astute investor in human history, or he was profiting mightily off selling offices at the national and provincial level. And we know a lot of that goes on. So in the case of Taiwan, you have a country that has, since I lived there, I visited Taiwan the first time in 1975. I was the engineer on one of the last U.S. naval vessels to visit the port of Kaohsiung in the south of Taiwan. I lived on the island for several years in the 70s and 80s and have been back frequently since. It is a free country. Since the 90s, there have been no fewer than five elections that have been free and fair. In fact, many people would argue that those elections were freer and fairer than the last one held in the United States. That's obviously a topic for another day. But the ultimate test of a democracy is the peaceful transfer of power from one political party to another after a free and fair election. Taiwan has passed that test not just once, but five times now. It is a fully functioning democracy where the people have the ultimate say as to how they will be governed. The difference between that and mainland China, which is ruled by a handful of old men who all aspire to be the reincarnation of Chairman Mao Zedong, one of the great butchers of human history, could not be starker. We have in office today, we have Xi Jinping, who's not president, by the way. There is no such office in China as president. That is a mistranslation of his real role, which is threefold. He's the General Secretary of the People's Liberation Army. He's the General Secretary of the Chinese Communist Party, and he's the head of government. But he's not the president. His ultimate power, of course, comes, as Chairman Mao said, from the barrel of a gun. That's why his position, his most important role, his most important title is the General Secretary of the Military Commission, which controls all the weapons of the People's Liberation Army. So on the one hand, you have a dictatorship. In fact, not just a standard old line dictatorship. You have a high-tech digital dictatorship, which is far advanced along the road of creating something that, you know, the people on the left of the political spectrum, the people who believe idealists in openness and freedom, supposedly, have always said is impossible. The People's Republic of China is very close to creating the first truly totalitarian dictatorship in the world, which is to say they're watching everybody all the time using smartphones, using security cameras, using artificial intelligence, constantly monitoring where people go, who they talk to, what they say on social media in real time, in real time. You know, the objection of the left to our use of the term totalitarian to refer to communism 40 years ago, 50 years ago was, you couldn't possibly have enough people watching everybody all the time to be a truly totalitarian state. Well, you don't need people, it turns out. If you have sufficiently sophisticated artificial intelligence, and if you have everybody holding a smartphone with a digital passport on it, tracking where you go, what you buy, who you talk to, you don't need everybody watching because you've got computers watching all the time. And that's what life is like in the People's Republic of today. It's called a social credit system. On Taiwan, of course, you are free to go where you want to go on the island and buy what you want and say what you want. There are competing political parties. There are massive numbers of you know, the, those mediating institutions like churches, like voluntary associations of all kinds, like Taoist temples, Buddhist temples, where people can go and associate without being monitored and controlled by the government. So it is a free society, which is precisely why the totalitarians on the other side of the Taiwan Straits want to kill it. Because what it does, what Taiwan demonstrates, beyond all doubt, is that the Chinese people are capable of enjoying, setting up, enjoying, and continuing to enjoy a full-fledged democracy, complete with respect for all manner of human rights. And that's precisely the lesson that the Chinese Communist Party does not want the Chinese people on the mainland to hear or to learn about. The democratic virus on Taiwan, they do not want to spread to mainland China because it would jeopardize their own rule. That's the source, the origin of the conflict between mainland China and Taiwan today, in my view.
Well, you know, I know some of the things that you mentioned in your book are the way China wants to, you know, be like the main world power. And I know I read the memoirs of a guy named Devlin. I don't remember his first name. He was the chief of station in the Congo in 1960. And he was telling the story about how the Soviets and the Red Chinese were sending consultants and agents into the interior of the Congo to foment violence. And then I'm also looking at, okay, Cambodia, the Khmer Rouge, they were Maoist, they were not Marxist. Today you've got, I think they control what, the Panama Canal, and they practically control much of Africa by sending agents in there. That's how they got the WHO to be practically under the control. I think the leader of WHO, I think is from Ethiopia, but he's been friends with the Red China. So, and then you got the islands that they're building in the Pacific. So, kind of, if you could, and I want to also mention before I ask you the question, there is a difference between the Mongols and the Chinese. So Genghis Khan and his followers went all the way to Budapest, and they went into Poland, conquering much of the known world. So can you explain your idea when you say the hegemon, the Chinese hegemon, how they want to control? Can you elaborate a little bit more on that, knowing the history of China and how much they've conquered?
Well, yeah, I mean, you mentioned a whole bunch of things there all at once. Dr. Tedros Ghebreyesus is a communist from Ethiopia. He's the head of the World Health Organization because he is China's guy. He was bought and paid for by the People's Republic of China, so he is a proxy representing principally the wishes of Beijing, which is one of the reasons why the pandemic was so mishandled at the beginning, continuing to the present day. China, the Chinese Communist Party. And remember, when we talk about China, I mean, sometimes I use the shorthand of China. I'm always referring to the Chinese Communist Party and the system of government that Chinese Communist Party has set up to rule over the masses of the Chinese people, who are, by the way, the first and foremost victims of the Chinese Communist Party. Some 80 million Chinese have been starved to death, tortured to death, or executed by the Chinese Communist Party since it began to strive for power after its formation in the 1920s. And I would add to that, of course, the 400 million little victims of the one-child policy, babies that were aborted before birth or killed by infanticide after birth by a party that was convinced that its road to power and prosperity lay through forcing hundreds of millions of women to get abortions, subsequently sterilizing them. So I think we have in the Chinese Communist Party quite clearly the biggest killing machine in human history, and I would lay at their feet the responsibility for the deaths of close to 500 million Chinese. So first and foremost, victims of the Chinese Communist Party are the Chinese people themselves. Having said that, the Chinese Communist Party is interested not just in controlling China. It has been in control of China since 1949, when Chairman Mao stood on top of the Tiananmen Gate, which was one of the four gates in the walls around the ancient medieval walls around Beijing that led into the center of the city. He stood on top of Tiananmen Gate on October 10th of 1949 and announced the founding of the People's Republic of China. But his ambitions only begin with reconstituting China's ancient empire. In 1950, he invaded what we now call Eastern Turkestan, what the Chinese call Xinjiang, which is where the Uyghurs live, the Kazakhs live. We'll talk about the Kazakhs and the Uyghurs in a minute, because China, the Chinese Communist Party, is committing genocide against this group of people. So they took this formerly independent area of Central Asia in 1950 by force. In 1959, they violated the agreement that they had with Tibet and invaded Tibet. And after a brief but bloody conflict, succeeded in taking Lhasa. And of course, the Dalai Lama fled over the Himalayas with 100,000 of his followers and set up a separate, you know, capital in exile in Dar es Salaam, India. In the case of Mongolia, China had half of Mongolia from almost the time of its establishment. The rest of Mongolia remains independent, the separate country today of Mongolia. But make no mistake, Mao made it very clear, and Xi, being a clone of Mao, the current ruler of China, has made it very clear that they want Mongolia back. In the course of history, the Chinese Communist Party say that in 1860, the Russians used false maps, fake maps, phony maps, to steal the Russian Far East and the port of Vladivostok from China. So China, at one point in the future, will make a territorial claim and will want that part of Russia back. So Putin has to watch his back, as it were, when he looks to China for aid, because they will want their territory back, and including the 250,000 square miles in Central Asia up into Siberia that was ceded by the Qing dynasty in, I think, 1767 under the Treaty of Nerchensk to Russia. They will want that territory back as well. Now, you mentioned the South China Sea, of course, historically was never part of China, but China has come up with cleverly crafted phony maps to do the same thing to its Southeast Asian neighbors that Russia did to it in 1860. It has said that since time immemorial, the South China Sea has belonged to China. And they want it not necessarily because of all the little islands features that are often underwater during high tide. They want it because that's the main shipping channel by which China gets energy from the Middle East up to China itself. They want to control the resources under the sea. They want to control that vital sea lane through which much of the world's commercial traffic goes. So China has territorial claims in all points of the compass, north, west, east towards Japan. I would mention that Japan now, of course, owns a little set of islands called the Senkaku Islands. In Chinese, they're Diaoyutai. And China says, no, those are Chinese islands. They have been since time immemorial. And by the way, since the daimyo, the Japanese ruler of Okinawa, a couple hundred years ago, used to pay tribute to the Qing court, we want the entire Ryukyu island chain as well. That's the island chain that stretches from the southernmost Japanese island of Sasebo, or rather Kyushu, I was once stationed in the port of Sasebo on the island of Kyushu, stretches for all the way down through Okinawa, down to almost the island of Taiwan. So China wants that back as well. And then we shouldn't forget that during the Tang Dynasty in the 8th and 9th century, that China also governed Vietnam. And the northern part of Vietnam was a Chinese province. And I think one day they will try to assert that claim as well. So they recently fought a war, not a war, but you know, there were company-sized engagements along the Sino-Indian border. And right now India says that China is sitting on huge swaths of territory that properly belong to India. And China's not content with that. It continues to encroach on the Indian border, building roads and artificial villages right up to and past what's called the line of control. So again, right now we have China aggressively expanding on all points of the compass, but it doesn't end, you see, with simply taking back territory that China once controlled, because the governing ideology of China says that China is one way to say China is as Zhongguo, which means the Middle Kingdom, the kingdom at the center of the earth. But there's another phrase I think that's even more revealing about the ambitions of the Chinese Communist Party. China historically was referred to as Tianxia. Tian means heaven and Xia means under. So China is literally all under heaven. What is all under heaven? Well, everything in the world as we know it is all under heaven. The rule of the Chinese sovereign, the God Emperor, that's what the Chinese phrase for emperor actually translates at, the Emperor God, the God Emperor. The Chinese God Emperor ruled over all under heaven, and his rule was theoretically unlimited. So that you talk about faraway places like Australia, Africa, places that the Qing Dynasty, the Ming Dynasty, the Manchu Dynasty, the earlier dynasties didn't even know existed, still theoretically fall under the rule of the God Emperor. And today's God Emperor, Xi Jinping, aspires to that role in the world. And it's very interesting to me, looking back at history, there were a couple of dynasties, of course, that resulted from horse lords, horse archers, invading from the north. That's why the Great Wall was built, to protect, of course, the China proper from invasions by the Mongols, the Manchus, and the other horse archer tribes of the northern plains, the far northern plains. The Great Wall failed, of course, on a couple of occasions. One was the Mongol dynasty that you've already mentioned, where the Mongols under Genghis Khan, Kublai Khan, reached all the way to the Black Sea, were only defeated at the gates of Warsaw and Hungary. But their empire was, I think, the largest empire the world has ever known. And today we find communist Chinese historians saying that, well, the Mongol emperor really wasn't a foreign emperor. It was an expression of Greater China. And therefore, we want to reestablish that empire. In other words, for centuries, they treated the Mongols and the Manchus as invaders. But now that it's convenient to use their empire boundaries, the boundaries of their empire, as a template for expansion, they've now suddenly brought the Manchus and the Mongols into the fold. And when I say bring them into the fold, I don't mean just in terms of drawing phony maps. I mean bring them into the racial and genetic fold. You see, because there is the Yellow Emperor, as he's called, is supposedly the father of all living Chinese. The Yellow Emperor, the first emperor, of which there is only myth and legend, no written documents, is said to have ruled the North China Plain thousands of years ago. And all living Chinese are said to be his descendants. It's like one giant lineage or one giant clan, to use anthropological terms. Well, in recent years, they have expanded the role, the paternity, as it were, of the Yellow Emperor to include not just the Han Chinese people, but the Manchus, the Mongols, the Tibetans, the Turkish-speaking Uyghurs of the far west. All of these are said to be the sons and daughters of the Yellow Emperor as well. And they don't mean that just in a cultural sense. They mean that in a biological sense as well. So you see this effort to give a kind of racial or ethnic cohesion to the expansion of the Chinese Empire, to justify the expansion of the Chinese Empire to include other peoples by claiming that they're all related ultimately to the same first ancestor, the Yellow Emperor, who lived thousands of years ago. I find that a very interesting justification for what China is doing today in terms of expanding its role.
That's fascinating. Now, you, in your book, Bully of Asia, you bring in, obviously, and you sort of touched on it in your answer, thousands of years of Chinese history. And one group that you mention in your book is the legalists. So I want you to discuss what the legalist movement was. But my question is, isn't communism in China today just a modern version of the ancient legalist rule?
Yeah, and people need to understand that China is really the one great alternative civilization in the world. That is, it grew up entirely separate from and without very little influence from the Western world, the rest of the world. And you can't say that about Western civilization, which of course percolated at various times throughout much of the world. So we have to, when thinking about Chinese civilization, we have to understand it has very different origins and a very different way of looking at life. And one of the things that I do is I compare the birth of Chinese civilization to the birth of Western civilization. We talk about, those of us who read history like you guys do, you know all about the Peloponnesian War. You know that in 431 BC that Sparta was fearful of a rising Athenian empire. And so Sparta assembled an army of, I think 4,000 hoplites and marched on Athens. They subjugated the city, but they didn't raise it to the ground. They didn't destroy it. They didn't enslave the Athenians. The Peloponnesian War lasted for three decades. They destroyed the Athenian fleet in 404 BC. But after that, the Spartans were not vindictive. They were magnanimous. They tore down the defensive walls of Athens. They took away its overseas possessions. They destroyed what remained of its fleet. But they didn't level the city. They accepted the Athenians as allies, and they appointed Spartan governors to do that. That is one way to treat your vanquished enemies with honor. That's not the Chinese way of war, because when the Qing dynasty defeated its enemies during the Warring States period, it often not only enslaved them, it would sometimes kill the enemy army, the defeated, surrendered enemy army to the last man. There was no idea of establishing a just peace or a long-lasting alliance. It was a war of all against all. And this went on for hundreds and hundreds of years. And here's the formative period in Chinese history. It begins in China's spring and autumn period, the 772 BC to about 481 BC. And at the beginning of that period, you've got feudalism in China. So you have feudalism in China, a thousand years before you have feudalism in the West. And you have the country, North China, the North China Plain principally, but going into Sichuan in the West and going down to Guangdong in the South, under the control of dukes and marquises and various kinds of, I'm using Western terms, so you have Chinese terms for all of these things, of course, and hundreds of little kingdoms. And pretty soon, they all start warring one against the other, and the bloodletting begins. And the bloodletting didn't consist just of a few thousand soldiers marching here and there as in the ancient Greek city-states. You had armies 500 years before the birth of Christ, you had armies of 100,000 men fighting against each other, vast hordes of soldiers and chariots, you know, fighting against each other on a continent-sized landscape. So three centuries of constant warfare. By the beginning of the Warring States period, I think that was 475 BC, you only had a few of these hundreds of kingdoms left. There were about a dozen. They were constantly warring against one another. And they learned during that period of time that alliances and treaties and non-aggression pacts and all of the other things that people now say that we should work out some kind of deal, some kind of accommodation with China and let them become a responsible member of the current world order. Well, they tried that, the Chinese did 2,500 years ago. They had alliances and treaties and they were trying to create a world order where states could exist peacefully alongside one another. And it didn't work. The conflicts, the bare bloody conflicts continued. So the country continued to coalesce. After 500 years, the state of Qin, under the rule of the man who became the first emperor of the Qin dynasty, succeeded in conquering all of the other states. And he succeeded in doing it by creating the first truly totalitarian state. Very interesting. The states that were successful in absorbing other states were those that had a standing military, had a state ideology, elevated the king to near God status, had song and dance troops going around the country singing the praises of the local king, the local emperor, had control over the economy, especially the production of iron and salt, because those you couldn't fight without the one and you couldn't live without the other. They had control over other aspects of trade and production as well. They had concentration camps, and they had conscription. People were required to serve in the military. So all of the things that we associate with modern Marxist-Leninism, from the concentration camps to a state ideology to the burning of books and the killing of scholars who proposed competing ideologies to propaganda corps to commissars in the military, control the political officers who control the military officers and make sure they don't revolt. All of these things were actually invented not by Karl Marx or Vladimir Lenin in the 19th or 20th century. All of these things were actually invented in China over 2,000 years ago. So they are deeply embedded in the Chinese system of governance, which continues to exist today on mainland China. So the end result, you know, was the abolition of freedom, the abolition of civil society, as the state really commandeered every available economic and social resource for total war. And the state that succeeded at doing that under this, you mentioned legalist, this was called Fa Jia. This was the legalist philosophy. The legalist philosophy means everything is to be mobilized. Every member of society, every economic resource is to be mobilized for total war with the idea that we cannot reach in some sort of modus vivendi, we cannot reach some sort of accommodation with neighboring countries. It is a situation where you must always over time kill or be killed. And so they learned how to kill very, very effectively. And you know, the ruler who emerged successful from this centuries-long carnage was the one who most perfected this totalitarian control of society in the name of the state. And that individual was the ruler of Qin, the ancient Chinese state of Qin, who they conquered Chu, they conquered the other Chinese states that existed at the time. And in 221 BC, he set himself up as the Qin Shi Huang Di. Qin for the Chinese state that he came from, Shi first, Huang, Emperor, Di, God. So he's the first emperor god of the Qin dynasty. We get China, the word China comes from Qin, because the Silk Road was operating during this time. And there was trade by land and by sea between the Qin Dynasty and the Roman Empire. And the Romans took the name Qin and made the word China out of it. And that's why we call the country today China. So Qinzhi Huangdi, utterly ruthless in his pursuit of power. He was known for slaughtering, surrendering armies, as well as Confucian scholars to the last man. He declared that he was divine. He demanded absolute obedience to him, the god emperor. And the Qin political order, we have this from Chairman Mao himself, Chairman Mao Zedong, right? The first red emperor of the Red Dynasty that rules China today, actually said that in one of his poems, that the Qin political order, the political order of total control of society and the economy that was set up by the first emperor of the Qin Dynasty, actually survived to the present day. So he saw that parallel. In fact, it wasn't just a parallel, it was a deliberate modeling and emulation of this ancient form of tyranny that was created in China 2,000 years before, that Mao set up in China when he established the People's Republic of China. Now, of course, it had a gloss of communism over the top of it. They pretended to adopt communism because it was a modern philosophy. It was a philosophy that commanded a respectful audience in the West. It was a philosophy that promised economic development quickly, industrialization quickly. But underlying that facade, underlying that fantasy that everyone was equal and the government was going to wither away, was the iron framework of legalism, of totalitarianism, which exists to the present day. And you really see the same thing in Chinese history, because as you can imagine, the first emperor of the Chinese dynasty, the first emperor of the Qin dynasty, was not a very popular guy. I mean, he was a mass murderer. And so when the Qin dynasty fell, as it did after a short time, the Han dynasty, the succeeding dynasty, found it useful to retreat a little bit from the blatant, cruel, barbaric features of legalism, and cover it up with the silken costume of Confucianism, where people are said to obey the government because it's the right thing to do. People are to obey the emperor just as younger sons are to obey older sons, just as wives are to obey husbands, just as students are to obey scholars, and so forth. That's the Confucian framework of thought that was used to cover up the tyranny that was embedded in the Chinese system of government from the very beginning. And Ross Terrell says it well. Ross Terrell of Harvard University said that Confucianism during dynastic times was the silken costume used to cover up the iron scaffolding of legalism that ultimately maintained the emperors in power. And today you see the same thing, only instead of the silken costume of Confucianism, you have the silken costume of communism, the fantasy of equality and withering away of the state, covering up the iron scaffolding of totalitarianism.
It's interesting. It's very similar to the silken costume you're always wearing. Yeah.
Anyway, I have to tell people.
Yeah, I apologize. It's called pajamas. Speaking of, so you have
no, we're not going to go there.
No, you don't like that?
Pajamas? Come on. Oh, yeah. What am I, selling healthcare here?
Right. Short shorts and a tank top.
Yeah.
Hey, so speaking of, like, we're talking about, 2,000 years ago, Qin, but to bring it into modern day, and the parallels are very similar. But you mention in your book that there, after Mao's rule, which was total, after his rule, there were rules and restrictions put in place by the Chinese Communist Party to ensure that whoever came into power did not have complete and total power as Mao did. However, you mention in your book that Xi Jinping has usurped if not all of those rules or restrictions, at least a lot of them. So how did he come about doing that? He is sort of he's the Mao of today, more or less. How did he come about doing that? And was he the first post-Mao ruler in China to do that?
Yeah, very interesting question. Mao, of course, like the first emperor of the Qing dynasty, Qin Shi Huangdi, over 2,000 years before, overreached. He sought total control. He sought total control in the 50s with endless purges and with the Great Leap Forward. The Great Leap Forward failed, and he encountered quite a bit of opposition within the Chinese Communist Party, and so he launched the Great Proletarian Cultural Revolution, where he mobilized millions of students who became acolytes of his, and in their youth and naivete were used by him as a battering ram to destroy his opponents within the Chinese Communist Party and within the government. And many senior communist leaders were killed, were tortured. Deng Xiaoping managed to survive because he was protected by an old friend of his who was a general in the People's Liberation Army. But many other senior leaders were not nearly as fortunate. And so after Mao died, and after his chosen successor was removed, the Deng Xiaoping, who never became, by the way, never became the chairman of the Chinese Communist Party, his highest rank was vice premier, but because of his close ties with the People's Liberation Army, he was in total control of the country. Deng Xiaoping, Vice Premier Deng, all of 5'1", decided that the Chinese Communist Party should reject part of Mao's legacy. He said Mao was 70% good and 30% bad. I would say he was pretty much 100% bad from the standpoint of human rights, but that was the official judgment of the Chinese Communist Party. And so the senior leaders of the party decided to put certain procedures in place to prevent anyone from ever amassing the kind of power that Mao Zedong had amassed and then used on his own senior party leaders, associates in the government and party. And they said, all right, we're going to limit everyone in the premiership and as general secretary of the Chinese Communist Party to 2 5-year terms. And we're going to make sure that while they're starting to serve those 2 5-year terms, that we have 2 other leaders waiting in the wings, more junior leaders, who are going to take their place in 10 years. So we're never going to be in a situation where we have a lifelong tyrannical dictator in place again, because the maximum length of time anyone will be allowed to serve as premier or general secretary of the Chinese Communist Party is 2 5-year terms. Well, that worked as long as Deng Xiaoping was alive, because he enforced it by his control of the People's Liberation Army. But Deng left the scene in 1995, he died. And so at that point, you had the transition that was to occur in 2002 already in place, because remember, they're working 10 years in advance. So we knew in 1992 that in 2002, we were going to have Premier Wen Jiabao come into control of the government, and we knew who the new general secretary of the Chinese Communist Party was going to be. But then Deng had left the scene, and Xi Jinping was elected in 2012 as president, as head of government, and then in the spring of the following year as the general secretary of the Chinese Communist Party and the head of the military commission. So he had control of all 3 levers of power. And he quickly began to destroy any opposition to his continued rule. He doesn't want to just rule for 10 years. He wants to rule as long as he has breath in his body. And so the first thing he did was he carried out an anti-corruption campaign starting right upon taking office. Now, there's no question that the Chinese Communist Party is corrupt. It is corrupt at every level. In fact, one might accurately describe it as institutionalized corruption, because every Chinese official at every level is skimming money off the top. And you know, there are historical precedents for that, because when the emperor appointed you to be the provincial leader of Guangdong province, he didn't provide you with a budget. You were expected to extract from the people of Guangdong province, where you were the provincial leader appointed by the emperor, you were expected to extract from the people of Guangdong province your substance, your support for your yamen, for your official residence, your support for the legal system, as well as extract taxes that would be sent back to the emperor. So there's a long historical precedent of officials in China taking all they can get from the offices that they're holding. We would call it today monetizing. So Chinese officials in China today are monetizing their offices all the time. So Xi Jinping, in carrying out a so-called anti-corruption campaign, had plenty of fat, juicy targets to pick. But he didn't just pick people at random. He began targeting his political enemies. And over the course of the last 10 years, he has literally had hundreds of thousands of Communist Party officials in the government and in the party, some in the military, arrested and sent to prison. Some have been executed. And if you look at the names, they're all members of other factions. That is, his own supporters have never been or rarely been accused of corruption, but the supporters of other cliques, other factions within the party, and there are many, are constantly being accused of corruption. And this is the key. The two people who were slated in 2012 to replace him and his premier in 2022 were early on accused of corruption. And they were removed from office and essentially kicked out of the party on charges of corruption. And therefore, he quickly disposed of in 2013, 2014, 2015, his potential successors. In the years since, he's consolidated his power. It'll be very interesting to see what happens at the next party Congress, because we expect him to get a third term and a fourth term. And he's only, 69 now. So I think he'll be in office for another 20 years or so. That's what he did. And, you know, we have in the West, we have constitutions. And we know how difficult it is to ensure that the controls, the checks and balances, the separation of powers that were brilliantly embedded into our constitution are abided by in this day and age, 200 and some years after the constitution was written. And we have a written constitution. These rules that were laid down by Deng Xiaoping that we've been talking about were never in a written constitution. They were just sort of the order of the day of the Chinese Communist Party. And they have no deep institutional roots. And now, of course, they've been uprooted and have gone by the wayside. They have removed, the one thing that has already happened is that the term limits, the two-term limit for Xi Jinping was removed some years ago. So there's no reason why he cannot be elected in quotes, to a third term. So the system has gone back to functioning the way it historically has functioned. That is to say, once you become the new Red Emperor, you serve in office throughout your entire lifetime.
Well, that's, I mean, Steve, the answers that you've given are fascinating. It's incredible that, I don't think a lot of people, I didn't know, I had always wondered if, you know, China had actually engaged in, because it's all, the emperor, right? And in any country, in any civilization, if you have an emperor, often, at least thousands of years ago, they were looked upon as gods. So I was always like, there had to be some type of tyrannical, totalitarian rule during that time. And I assume that it just expanded all the way through here. So it's almost like it's not that different now than, I guess, in many ways, as it used to be. But Stephen, the answers that you've provided are just really, I'm sort of awestruck because there's just so much information there that you give. And the book, The Bully of Asia, is just, ladies and gentlemen, highly encouraged. You wrote this in 2017, I believe. Am I correct?
Right. And, you know, it's based on an earlier work of mine called Hegemon, which I wrote in 2000. And then, of course, we have a new paperback edition with some changes and a new introduction that was just published by Regnery Press. So it's something that, you know, I've been following for the last 45 years. I was the first American social scientist, as you may have noted, to be allowed to go to the People's Republic of China and do a full-length field study of life under communism. I was on the ground in China about 2 months after we normalized diplomatic relations in 1979. And I can speak, read, and write Chinese, Mandarin, Cantonese, and Taiwanese. And so I was able to have the kind of access that no one before, and I believe no one after me, has had to ordinary Chinese people, to communist Chinese officials, who were very, very open with me, because I had permission from Deng Xiaoping himself to be in China. Because at the beginning of the U.S.-China relationship, when we were just talking to China about normalizing diplomatic relations, which happened on January 15th of 1979, we set up a scholarly exchange program between China and the United States. I was one of the first 50 scholars to be selected by the American side to go to China. I was the only social scientist. I was one of the few who could speak, read, and write Chinese. And the Chinese Communist Party turned me down. And it was only after former President Jimmy Carter brought up the matter of my research in a meeting with Deng Xiaoping, that Deng Xiaoping, Vice Premier Deng, effective control of the country, said it will be no problem for Stephen Mosier to come and do research in China, that I went to China. All doors were open to me. So I had the kind of access that that other scholars could only dream of. And I believe I was able to get to the heart of the matter then. And of course, I followed China in the years since. I've been to China numerous times. It's increasingly difficult for me to go because you can understand that they don't like my description of their rule very much. But that's a little bit about my history.
Well, speaking of an open door, like this really is an open door to China. Ladies and gentlemen, I can't encourage, if you're wanting to know about China, which is, from my perspective, the number one threat America faces, the West faces, I hope you do purchase Bully of Asia. It is an incredible breakdown of what has been and what is going on in China and why it's a threat to Western civilization in particular, and also the Chinese people.
Well, you know, Canadian Prime Minister Trudeau thinks they're...
Oh, yeah, he's a big fan. Yeah. He's a
so
big fan.
If Trudeau likes it, then, you know, I think...
Which makes it difficult on me, because I'm a huge Trudeau fan, and therefore, I guess, indirectly, I'm a big fan of the Chinese Communist Party. Is that correct?
Well, no? I mean, I think we need to give them more, you know, was it that WTO or whatever it is? That
World Trade?
The World Trade Organization? Yeah, we need to give them...
Give them more access. Yeah, let them do things. Yeah. No, it's...
You know, we should build a facility there for viruses.
Hey, that's a good idea. Know? Yeah. Steve, it was fantastic talking to you. Thanks so much. Incredible information. And thank you very much for all the work that you're doing and keeping people abreast of the situation.
Thank you, guys.
All right. I got to tell you, I was quite impressed, because I threw out a lot of, questions, I guess.
My
question
to.
Was pretty big, but there was a reason for that. And he answered everything. And I was going to ask him a third question, but he answered that. Yeah. You know, the big one was about, the Mongols and... You know, how do the Chinese view them? And when he said that the Mongols and the Chinese were one family, I was like, okay, so then that means they will claim, the western half of, the eastern half of Budapest. Because Budapest,
It's fascinating answers,
all
man.
All that is they consider it theirs.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I think a lot of people, including myself, have always thought that these land grabs are about just obtaining land and material, right? Well, no. Mm-hmm. They truly believe that they are the hegemon. They should be ruling all of society, like all under heaven should belong to them. It's fascinating. The read is fascinating. Mm-hmm. And what a fascinating conversation. Like yeah. The answers, long, thorough, mm-hmm. but precise. Like you want information? That's what you needed. Yeah.
You know, China has always fascinated me. I am, like he was saying, he's a fan of the Chinese people, not the present government. Right. I don't like the present government.
No.
And, you know, I've been reading Sun Tzu, is what he was saying. I was saying Sun Tzu. Anyway.
Sure.
So I read The Art of War. Pretty interesting. But, you know, there are several other military classics. And I've read Marco Polo's book. So, you know, China has always been fascinating, but damn, you know, the present government really, really is a threat. And I'm glad he wrote this book to kind of, warn people. Yeah. Warn people.
And
guys,
to
they're not our friend.
Right. And to have an under, and not really even a friend of any nation.
I mean, even Russia thinks that, you know, he was pointing out that, you know, Russia is become buddy-buddy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we could have, I really do believe we could have made Russia our friend in the 90s when the Soviet government fell.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we pushed them towards China, but China's going to stab them in the back.
Exactly. And we tried to bring in China to be partners with it. Just like really bad geopolitical policies. All right. Book and movie recommendation?
Let's begin.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, I think it is pretty freaking obvious. This is a fantastic book. This book will blow your mind. It really would. Will. So much information. Stephen goes way back into history, gives you a breakdown of China, and ties it into the modern era of what China is now. So Bully of Asia, go get it. Bookstores, online, wherever you want to go, check it out. Movie recommendation. I'm going to go with what you mentioned a second ago. There was a series, called Marco Polo on Netflix. Pretty good series. I stopped watching it because it just got a little too sexual. Look, hey, I love beautiful women, but it just got too much. I'm like, nah, I think I'm done with it. So
what,
now,
they,
if you
had
can,
sex scenes in it or what?
No, it just wasn't just sex scenes, but just it was pretty erotic type of stuff.
Oh,
and
then
so I'm like, okay.
I don't know if I should mention my movie then, but
yeah.
Hey, go
well,
ahead.
I'm just saying, like, there's some people who don't mind, you know, exposing themselves to things like that. I mean, I don't know who, but I'm not one of those people. But I did enjoy the show. I think I got through like the first season and everything. But anyways, pretty good show if you can deal with all the sexual erotic stuff. Violence, I'm fine with. But it just got out of hand.
So you're okay with the violence but not the sex?
Yeah.
So you're not a make love not war type of guy?
I'm a make war not love guy.
Okay. Yeah. Well, all right. Yeah, I'm going
to... That's why I'm a big fan of like your buddy Sean Hannity purporting for us to go to war with Russia. Big fan. And Lindsey Graham, too. Why don't somebody needs to assassinate Putin? Like,
you know,
you're talking
Lindsey
about
Graham,
a bunch of morons.
Lindsey Graham, he reminds me of some people I knew who were bipolar. Sometimes I like what he has to say. Other times I'm like, really?
Yeah.
I mean, I know he loves war.
And McCain.
Lindsey Graham and McCain never saw a war they didn't like.
Yeah. So.
But, you know, there was a Marco Polo series in the early 80s. The father of Marco was the guy, he was in the Raiders of the Lost Ark. That
Sean Connery?
Well, no. His fumbling friend. He was a professor.
Okay, yeah.
I forgot his name.
Oh, man.
But Brody, I think. I think the character's name was Brody.
Was it Brody?
I think. But he's kind of like a fumbling.
He'll blend in.
Yes.
He knows.
Yes, that guy right there.
He's
that
like,
guy.
Hello?
Well, he plays, I think, like the father of Marco Polo. But yeah, this is back in the 80s, mm-hmm. early 80s. And fascinating, just a fascinating story. Yeah. So anyway, okay, so yeah, mine is going to be the Bully of Asia also. Mm-hmm. You know, the Red China is a threat, you know. Now, you know, we like the people of Taiwan, you know, and I mean, we like the people of China themselves. We just hope that, you know, I remember in 89 watching the Tiananmen Square thing, and I was hoping, you know, all those other communist governments fell. Please let mm-hmm. China fall also.
Yeah. So, and he mentions that in his book, how yeah. the intervention,
you know, and the Bible the also communist mentions Party the was... kings of the East, a 200 million man army.
I'm telling you, dude. And the dragon.
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah. Well,
the dragon will give us power.
I think the dragon was the devil, wasn't he? Satan? I don't know.
Well, you think about it. Like, everything is in the book of Revelation. I don't want to get off topic, but everything in the book of Revelation is like, there's tons of like metaphorical descriptions mm-hmm. basing on animals and different things like that line yeah. up with a lot of the nations, like the bear. You know, it's very interesting.
Well, okay, so movie.
Why not the dragon?
My movie is going to be The White Queen. I know that first word might offend some people, but
absolutely,
you know, I don't care. Who, you know, hopefully they're not watching us anyway. Okay, now The White Queen. When I mentioned This Week in History, I talked about, you know, the Wars of the Roses and Edward IV. Okay, this is about the wife of Edward IV. Her name was Elizabeth. She was a widow, a Lancastrian widow, so she marries a Yorkist, or hell, marries the head of the York family. Did I mention Rebecca Ferguson? Did I say that?
No, not yet.
Okay, so that's Rebecca Ferguson, who...
Yes, you like her very much.
Well, did you see her in that Mission Impossible? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so...
Yes,
yeah.
She's awesome.
Yeah, she is awesome. So Rebecca Ferguson plays Elizabeth, and it's you know, yeah, they do kind of take license, whatever that word is, say.
Sexual license.
And there's quite a bit. So, you know, don't let your kids, you know, under maybe 13, I don't know. If they're not in high school, okay, well, high school, yes, let them watch it in high school. But yeah, there's a lot of sex. There's a lot of sex in this.
Yeah. Yeah. So what you're saying is, like, if you had kids and they were like 14, you'd be sitting down watching it with them.
Well,
is that what you're saying?
You know, maybe, I don't know. No, I wouldn't. Okay. You know, I would probably think of.
Well, that brings our show to an end. All the sex you want on The White Queen.
It's called The White Queen. So it's
and Marco Polo.
Got Edward. It's got George. It's got Richard. The guy who plays Richard III. Mm-hmm. He's going to be Richard III. Shows all that. It's pretty good. It goes through a long timeline. Yeah.
Dick, right?
You know, he was killed in Bosworth, so I think it's a little too soon to be making.
That is
1485. Come on. You know, they found him under a parking lot not too long ago. Mm-hmm. Richard
I think
III.
We mentioned that a little bit ago.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah,
once again, I'm about to put
all
you there.
In there. Henry,
I'm going to break
Henry
in.
Tudor.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, go check us out. All you right. can subscribe to us on YouTube. Please do so. We've got our episodes up on Rumble. Check us out on Facebook and Instagram, and definitely our website, www.thesonsofhistory.com. We got to get out of here. I'm done having you over here and ruining my entire day. We'll talk to you later. Have a great week.
You always do that.